Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects today with P.J. Leash, who is manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. We'll be talking about the work the lab does with P.J., and he'll be telling us about some really unusual insects that were found in Wisconsin this year. And, of course, we'll be taking all of your bug-related questions as well, and I hope you'll join in. You can phone us at 1-800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page, and maybe you've got a cool insect photo, and we always love to see those photos as well. Maybe you've got something kind of weird, or at least something you want to have PJ try and identify for you. And of course, he will give it his best shot. His best shot is usually the right one. PJ, great to have you back.
Yeah, pleasure to be here, Larry.
Before we start talking about the unusual bugs that we've seen in the insect diagnostic lab, maybe talk about what the lab does.
Sure. So the insect diagnostic lab was started about 40 years ago. And basically the goal of the lab is to provide insect identification resources for Wisconsin residents. And so it could be a member of the general public. It could be one of my colleagues, an extension agent, something along those lines. It could be a farmer. It could be a medical doctor. Basically, if anyone has something creepy crawly in the state they want identified, it often ends up coming across my desk. And so I get all kinds of emails and phone calls and online messages.
Any costs connected with this for a person?
No, I don't have any fees. At the moment, I mostly handle cases from within the state just because there's some issues with sending insects from other states here. But if on occasion someone will send me pictures from other states in the U.S., or this year alone I've gotten pictures of cool insects from about 11 different countries across the planet. So I get to see some pretty neat stuff, but no costs. The easiest way to find out about us would be to go to the website. If you just do a Google search for UW Insect Identification or Insect Diagnostic Lab, you should be able to find my site.
And we have a link on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show as well. Well, tell me about some of the unusual bugs that got into your lab this year.
Sure. Well, so each year I always see the common bugs. I mean, the Japanese beetles and box elder bugs and things like that. But what really kind of I enjoy the most is some of these weird creatures that come in. So, for example, I had my first ever case of imported fire ants in the state. And these are the creatures you've got to go down to Texas to find. Now, this was really an accidental introduction. They're not going to be able to survive our winters, anything like that. So it's not like they're setting up shop here. That particular situation, there was a train that had been sitting in a railroad yard down in Mississippi for a couple months for repairs. The ants had moved into the engine battery compartment, and so the train came up to Appleton and Fond du Lac area, and all of a sudden the conductor was getting stung by fire ants. And so pest control was called in. They took care of it. We haven't seen any more evidence of ants, but it just goes to show there's all kinds of weird things like that that show up on occasion. So we had fire ants. I've had some really weird flies and dragonflies and things like that show up. And some of them are just bizarre creatures.
How do they, and for the most part, I often think, well, I wonder, you know, if you get, if a company or a business gets a set of plants, for example, for their horticultural area of their business, and they might come in from the south.
Sure.
That's probably how a lot of this happens as well, I would think.
Yeah, with certain insects, they can definitely get moved around with nursery stock plants and things like that. Now, Wisconsin and other states, they do have nursery inspection programs. And if you think of all the millions of plants that get shipped around, most of them are going to be clean and free of these insects. On occasion, something does get moved into the state, though. An example of that would be the lily leaf beetle, which is an invasive species that showed up in Wausau area about 2 years ago. I suspect it probably came in on some type of plant stock from elsewhere in the country, and it's kind of spread around that area since then.
And sometimes a UW professor, I think somebody gave you kind of a pretty rare moth the other day.
Yeah, so we had a picture come in of a very unusual moth called the white-tipped black. And this is a moth from the inchworm family. And typically to find it, you have to go down to some of the Gulf Coast states, or this same species can be found even down into South America. So we had not ever seen it before in Wisconsin. For whatever reason, one was spotted here on the UW-Madison campus at the Botany Garden. It was just sitting on a plant taking nectar. How it got up here, I suspect air and wind currents. And we have many documented cases of where this can happen. And if you think about the weather, we've had a very kind of late, warm fall. The jet stream may be doing some weird things. All kinds of weird creatures can get carried up here from down south on occasion with those types of unusual weather patterns.
I'm looking at our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And is that moth that you're seeing on the page, is that the one you're talking about?
Yes. So this is the...
It's really pretty.
Yeah, it really is. It's got black wings, jet black wings, with white tips on the wings, hence the name of white tip black. And it's got an orange thorax and head on the thing. So it's very unique looking. When the photographer had spotted it, he knew that it was something unusual and got in touch with a number of us, and we figured out it was this very unusual species, possibly even from Central or South America.
But not one we're going to see every day here in Wisconsin.
No, not by any means. This is the type of thing that you might have drift up here once every 5-10 years, that sort of thing. There are these unusual creatures that do that.
You found some nasty spiders as well, didn't you?
Yeah, so when I get a spider question or picture at the diagnostic lab, usually the first question I get is this a brown recluse spider? And, you know, brown recluse spiders are medically important spiders. If they bite under certain cases, there can be some medical complications with it. Now, if you look at the native range of that spider, though, you've really got to go down to places like Arkansas and Missouri and Oklahoma in the central southern part of the U.S. We just don't have them natively here. Now, over the last couple decades, there have been a few incidents where brown recluse spiders have been found in the state. Now, in those cases, they are restricted to a single home or a single building, and someone almost certainly brought them up here when they moved and the spiders had snuck into a box of books or something like that. Now, earlier this year, I had gotten an email and the individual had said, I think I have brown recluse spiders. I asked for a picture. I got a picture. Sure enough, that's what they looked like. And then I didn't hear much else for a few months. And then in about July and August, I got a few more cases of brown recluse spiders, and they were all from Appleton, Wisconsin. And I said, this is really suspicious because if you understand about the biology of brown recluse spiders, they are very, very bad at moving themselves around. They just would have a hard time leaving one home, crossing the street, and getting to the next. So they have very limited dispersal capabilities. And so I had gotten in touch with a colleague, Mike Draney, who is an arachnologist up at UW-Green Bay, and I asked Mike if he had ever had reports from Appleton, Wisconsin. And all of a sudden, we started connecting all these dots, and they all trace back to the same apartment building. So pest control got involved. They're taking care of the issue, but things like that do show up in the state on occasion.
On occasion. I remember Chuck Koval, an entomologist at UW, rest his soul, who I think talked about the first one that he had ever seen, probably the first one identified in the state, and that was quite a few years back.
Yeah,
but you don't hear about them very often. But it's always kind of probably fun from your point of view, just the little detecting that has to go on to figure things out.
It is, yeah. With those brown recluse spiders, I was definitely scratching my head, but as I said, I knew about the very limited dispersal capabilities, and I said, this doesn't make sense that there'd be different infestations in Appleton. And as I said, we connected all those dots, traced it back to the same building, or really it was two buildings that shared a wall. It was an old mill building.
Well, we have every line is filled, so we should take some calls here. And Susan in Kenosha has been waiting a bit. Susan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Hello. I had a question about springtails.
Okay.
Every place I've lived has had springtails in some number or other, and I had one home in Kenosha that had a lot of them, and I don't know how to get rid of them. I've tried using, things that you can buy at Home Depot, and I had called a well-known pest control company to come out, and they didn't even know what springtails were, And I had another pest control guy there in Kenosha. He was using Talstar, and that would work for a certain amount of time, but then they just keep coming back. Are they just inevitable that you're going to get them if you live on top of a rough patch, I guess? Or is there a way to get rid of them?
It kind of depends on the situation, and the local environment can have a pretty big influence on this. So I guess my first question for you, Susan, where are you seeing the springtails mostly? Is this outside of the home, or are you finding them inside your house?
No, inside. They can be outside all they want.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, inside that particular house in Kenosha had them in the windowsills and around the doors, a lot of them in the basement because we had sort of a lookout basement, and also on certain times of the day when it got really warm, they would come in and you'd see them all over the walls on that west-facing wall, and they'd be inside the wall at that point, you know, so in the evening if you had the light on, they'd want to come over towards the light. I mean, they're just small little crawly things. They don't hurt anything, but you don't want bugs all over your home either. So
yeah. Right.
Do they like a certain kind of environment?
Yeah, basically springtails or columbellans, they like damp conditions. They feed on a variety of things, rotting vegetation and fungal spores and things like that. So if you have lots of springtails, it means there's something damp around. Now, outdoors with mulch beds and compost piles, and especially with a rainy year, you get lots of springtails outside. Now, in some cases, the springtails can move indoors, sneak in through door frames, basement windows that perhaps need to fit a little bit more snugly. And so if we can go around and tighten things up, that should help problem. Now, there can be some unusual situations where if your basement is very damp and you had some mold growing in the walls, if you had a partially finished basement, that could potentially be a food source for them. But typically, I think of springtails as being outdoor creatures, and so they are most likely sneaking in somehow. So sealing things up as best we can should help. Some of the products like the Talstar certainly can help, and that comes from a group we call the synthetic pyrethroids. They will work for about a month at a time to keep things outside so that they can't sneak in. But it may take repeated applications if you have lots of springtails, and that may be influenced by your landscaping. Another thing that may help is around your home, if you have plants right up against the foundation, if we can move those back a little bit, get some more airflow right along the foundation, dry things out, that'll make it less hospitable for the springtails there, and that may help prevent them from sneaking in too.
Yeah. But if you tighten up the house a little bit, that's going to help as well.
Yeah, I would definitely expect that to help.
All right. Thanks, Susan, for calling. Appreciate it. Good luck to you. And Barb in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Barb.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
This is from the unusual to the very mundane. I have friends that have fleas. They've gotten it in from a cat, and they've washed the cat 3 times. But they're not letting the cat in the bedroom. How would you get rid of fleas other than calling a flea company and having it?
Yep.
Sure. So a couple of things when it comes to fleas. First of all, the source is an animal of some kind. In this case, we know it's a cat. If there were no pets in the home, then I would have to start looking for, raccoon living in the attic or something like that. But you got to treat the pet, and I would chat with your veterinarian to figure out best product to use for that. That will stop the fleas at the source, which is that animal. But then we can have fleas left over in the environment. We can have adult fleas hopping around on the carpet and in places like that and on couches. And
where the cat sleeps.
Yeah, exactly. You hit the nail on the head, Larry. When it comes to flea control, you have to think of where the animal spends their time. And dogs are easy. They like to hang out on the dog bed. Cats hide in weird spots. If you go to those areas, regular vacuuming can actually help quite a bit because you will have juvenile fleas down amongst the carpet fibers. Over time, those turn into adults. And so regular vacuuming, you're basically siphoning them off from the population. If need be, there are some insecticide treatments that can be applied to carpeting and furniture and things like that. But often, if you do a very, very thorough job of vacuuming, we're talking about every day, maybe even twice a day vacuuming, and treat the animal, that should really help quiet things down. And also, the fall weather and winter weather, drier conditions are very harsh on fleas, so that should help us out in this case as well.
All right. Thanks very much, Barb, for calling. Appreciate it. P.J. Leash, our guest today. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will be talking about what the Republicans will do now that they have all three branches of government. That's at 1. Right now, taking a look at the world of insects with P.J. Leash of the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. A couple of open lines you want to join in, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And certainly if you have some insect photos you want us to take a look at, or just for general information, it'd be a lot of fun for you to do that as well on our Facebook page. Sandy and Madison, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi, Larry and PJ. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I just have a curiosity question. So I'm one of these people that does catch and release when I find bugs in the house. We have a designated jar and a card that slips under it to trap the insect and deposit it outdoors. So I've found these when there's been ants that we found, not in Wisconsin. When I'm visiting my mother in New York State, upstate New York.
Yeah.
And so we go to take it outdoors and dump it out on the lawn, and it hangs from a web swinging. Do we have spider ants?
Well, so
it's an ant that spins a web.
Sure.
So it doesn't hit the ground crash.
So that sounds a little odd to me. I'm not aware of any ants that would do that. What I wonder, though, there are certain spiders that can actually look very, very ant-like in appearance. And if you think of the insect world, ants are pretty fierce predators. Not a lot of things will go and mess with ants. And so there are all kinds of spiders and flies and other things that will mimic ants. And by virtue of appearance, they are protected. And so I would wonder if maybe I'd bumped into some unusual spider that happened to look like an ant. That would explain the silk production.
Well, I've seen many of these in her house.
Okay, well, that's a little odd. What I would maybe do in that case, you mentioned this was out in New York, I believe?
Yes.
I would collect some and get them into your local extension office out there in New York. And they do have a insect diagnostic lab out in New York that could look at physical specimens. I would maybe just get some specimens into an entomologist that can take a closer peek at them and potentially narrow it down more.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Sandy. Appreciate it. And on to Candy in Suring next. Hi, Candy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have cylindrical millipedes at my house. They're outside. They crawl up the garage. They come out of the cracks in the sidewalk. And it's really infested. There are just billions and billions of them. And I called somebody, a lady at the extension, and she sent me some articles and said to use an insecticide and spray it around the garage. And that I did that. I sprayed it around the garage and in all the cracks. And that was fine for about half a day. And then more came. And more came. And I was wondering if there is something stronger that I could use. I just used something from the hardware store. And should I do that in the spring or fall? And do you have any other suggestions besides insecticides?
Sure. So millipedes can be tricky to deal with. Now, the thing with millipedes is they're kind of like the springtails we chatted about a couple minutes ago. They're associated with damp conditions.
Yeah.
So you can have compost piles and things like that. Now, what happens with millipedes is they can go through these population booms, and at certain times of the year, we get these mass movements. Sometimes in the spring, I get lots of reports in the fall, and I get pictures where the millipedes can pile up inches deep along a foundation or garage door. Now, the issue going on there is you can apply an insecticide to the outside of your home. It will kill the first millipedes that contact it, but the other ones just pile up on top, and so they never come in contact with this stuff. Now, unfortunately, there aren't really great ways to deal with these large numbers. Now, on a positive side, this does tend to be a fairly temporary thing, a phenomenon. So we'll see mass migration in the fall, and with cooler temperatures coming, I would expect them to quiet down fairly soon. In the grander scheme of things, if we can figure out the source of the millipede, now, I know it seems like they're coming out of cracks in the driveway and things like that. That's not where they're living and breeding. They can congregate in the areas. Millipedes are going to be breeding in areas with a lot of decaying plants and things like that. So if you have agricultural fields or prairie or CRP land around you, that's probably the source. Now, at night, the millipedes can wander, and they can even wander potentially a couple hundred yards. So if you can find the source and treat the millipedes closer to the source, that may stop them from wandering up to the home. But otherwise, they wander at night. When the sun comes up, they're looking for a damp, dark location, which is why they congregate on concrete slabs and along the driveway and garage door and things like that. But when they get to those areas, if they get exposed to sunlight, they're really going to die in a day or two anyways.
Yeah, they die, but they really pile up. Shovels full I have taken out of dead ones after I spray them. Behind my barn, it seems that there was a deep drop-off there, a sharp drop-off, and they filled it back in the day, probably in the 1980s, something like that, with sawdust. Do you think I should be spraying back over there behind the barn? It's probably just the edge of the barn would probably be about 15 feet from the garage.
Okay. What I would do is perhaps head out at night or early in the morning with a flashlight and see, because if you see an awful lot of millipedes around there, that may suggest that that could potentially be a source. Otherwise, if you peek there and you're just not seeing millipede activity, that's probably not the source. It's probably something else in the landscape nearby.
Will I just see them on the grass?
Well, they can wander through the grass. I wouldn't expect them to breed in large numbers in the grass unless potentially if you had really heavy thatch accumulation in your lawn and you had a lot of buildup of organic material, and if that were decaying, that could be potential food for millipedes. But often if you know of, you know, wooded area, woodlot near you, or farm fields or CRP or prairie land, that is often the key breeding source, and they're simply wandering from those areas.
Okay. All right.
All right. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And David in Anawa has something for us next. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Well, I work on my dairy farm, buzz around on my four-wheeler a lot, and I've been running into clouds of tiny blue and white fuzzy gnats. And my dad and I have been noticing them. He has never seen them on the farm in 20 years. Can you have any ideas of what they might be? I can't get a picture of them. They're just too small.
Sure. And do they look like a little piece of lint kind of floating through the air?
Yeah, really fuzzy.
Okay. What I suspect, you've probably bumped into some creatures we call woolly aphids. And they have a whitish fuzzy appearance, but if you look at them up close, they do have a tint of blue to them. And these are plant feeders. And at certain times of the year, especially in the fall, it's not uncommon to see these things just kind of floating through the air. They do look like floating little lint balls, harmless to people other than if you're riding around, they might smack into you and smush on your vehicle, but that's about it.
Yeah, I get a mouthful once in a while.
There you go.
Willie Aphid, thank you.
Thanks, David. And Robbie in Milwaukee, what's on your mind? Hi.
Hi. I was noticing a problem at my house this summer with some type of a moth. And there's a whole bunch of them, and I've never seen them. I live in the city of Milwaukee, not far from St. Joseph's Hospital. And I finally took a picture and sent it to your guest. And he told me that we had gypsy moths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've never seen them all my years living in the city. And I wondered if he could talk a little bit about this pest and what city residents should do to keep an eye out for them, and if there's anything we could do to stop them from eating all of our trees.
Sure. So gypsy moths are a pretty important invasive species, and they've been in the state for many years now. And they're not found statewide. If you go to the western row of counties that borders the Mississippi and Minnesota and things like that, we don't really see gypsy moth there yet. But the eastern two-thirds of the state, it's been around for some time. Now, in the grand scheme of things, gypsy moth has the potential to cause some pretty significant defoliation of trees and wooded areas. Luckily, the last few years, their numbers have been relatively low. And the reason for that is under damp, rainy conditions, there is a fungal disease that pops up that kills off the caterpillar. So it keeps their numbers in check. If we had a very dry year, a couple dry years in a row, then potentially their numbers would build up. But at least in the last several years, the rainy conditions have really kind of kept their numbers in check. One thing you could do anytime between now and basically next spring is go out and look for the egg masses of gypsy moth.
Yeah, so, on the trees.
Yeah. They'll be on trees. They can be on other things, too. The side of homes, piles of firewood, undersides of trucks and trailers that have sat for long periods of time, which is one of the reasons there's the billboards out there saying don't move firewood, because these egg masses can be on non-plant material like firewood, and it gets moved around. The egg masses themselves look like basically a velvet. They're kind of a very fuzzy beige color, an inch or two long, and the female basically lays all her eggs in one bundle. That mass of eggs can have anywhere from 500 to 600, maybe even 1,000 eggs. And so if you find those and you simply scrape them off with a putty knife any other tool and physically remove them and put them into a bucket of soapy water to drown them, something like that, you can take care of potentially thousands of gypsy moths, and you won't have them hatching out next spring.
They are all over any surface available. They're on my garage. They're on the wood part, on the brick part. They're mm-hmm. Quite a lot of them are kind of hiding, like right under an overhang with underneath the window.
Yep.
I don't see them in my great big elm in my backyard, but I do see them in the trees out on the street, and I did notify the city,
mm-hmm.
And they said that they would try to do some treatment in the spring to try to get them off the trees, but there is quite a big number right around this area.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, and I have heard of some other reports in southeastern Wisconsin where I've gotten lots of reports of large numbers of egg masses. So what you're describing isn't entirely unusual. And as I described with the removal of egg masses, it can take some manual labor, but those eggs aren't going to hatch until next spring, probably sometime in April or May. And so we've got several months where we can go out and do some damage to those gypsy moths and take care of them before they hatch.
Yeah, I actually did that in one of our local parks. I went around and there were a lot of the egg masses on the trees, and I just scraped them off. I must have scraped off 50 egg masses,
mm-hmm.
and there's probably 50,000.
Potentially, yeah. You can, if you got kids or grandkids and you have gypsy moth
a half
around,
hour,
yeah.
You can do a lot of damage to the to the gypsy moth population in a half hour.
Yeah.
If you find those egg masses.
Yeah. Is it better to do that scraping off now or in the spring?
Well,
whenever it's handy.
Yeah, I would say whenever it's handy, because as I mentioned, the eggs themselves aren't going to hatch until next April or May. So we've got some time. We've got several months here where you could go out and take care of them.
Yeah.
Okay. And I just wanted to ask one other thing that I thought was so interesting in my email conversation with you. I saw all the pupae and I saw the moths, but I didn't see the caterpillars. And I was just so surprised at why I didn't see that part of the life cycle. And you pointed out one thing that was very interesting to me, and that is that the caterpillars feed and are active at night.
Yeah, so unless you're taking a close peek, you might not see the caterpillars. Now, one thing that people can do is if you look up at your oak or other tree and you're noticing damage and you suspect gypsy moth, we can take a piece of twine or string, wrap it around the trunk, and drape a sheet of burlap from that. And then at periods of the day when the gypsy moth caterpillars aren't actively feeding, they'll wander down and hide beneath that burlap. Well, you can go out during the afternoon and squish or scrape those caterpillars off and take care of them then too. So there are a number of kind of non-chemical tricks we have up our sleeve for dealing with gypsy moths.
And Robbie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Ron emailed to say his friend encountered a very large, strange insect while cutting firewood in northern Wisconsin. Said it looked like the creature from the Alien movie. Unfortunately, it freaked him out so much he immediately whacked it with his chainsaw. What he described sounded very much like a Jerusalem cricket, very large, not worm-like. I don't think they range this far north and east. Any idea what else it might be, or could it be a Jerusalem cricket?
Well, it wouldn't be a Jerusalem cricket. We just don't have those around these parts. Couple potential ideas. One thing I would think of, we have a creature called a camel cricket. Sometimes they're called cave crickets, and they'll show up in basements on occasion. And they look just like oversized crickets with the legs, tip of the hind legs to the head can be, in some cases, maybe 2 or so inches long. So they definitely can be good size. They can be fairly common in damp areas. I've seen them along riverbeds and damp woods and places like that. So that would be my top guess. We do also technically have something called a mole cricket in the state, although they are very uncommon. I've never encountered one myself. In Wisconsin, if you go down south, they can be more common. But I would think the camel or cave cricket would probably be my top suspect at this point.
Jeff and Grand Marsh up next. Hi, Jeff. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I actually come up with another question as well. But the woolly caterpillars we see in October, what do they become? And the tent caterpillars, what do they become?
Okay.
Sure. So both of those turn into moths. The adult stage is a moth. With the woolly caterpillars, they will go through the winter in that caterpillar stage and then turn into the adult moth sometime next year. With the tent caterpillars, they are going through the winter as egg masses, which will hatch in the spring. And that's why we see all the silken tents in April and May and black cherry trees out in the woods. But both those turn into moths that are kind of brownish or pale in color.
There we go. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate the call. We had a cool photo here from Gil, who took a photo of a very strange leaf-like moth. He's seen it on the east side of Madison on a wall by a convenience store.
Yeah, so this is something from the Sphinx moth family, and there's a number of moths in this group that have a very triangular or delta-shaped body in the manner that they hold the wings. Now, I'd have to look at my moth book to narrow down the exact species. I think I can see enough of the wing patterns to do that, but it definitely looks like something from the Sphinx moth family.
It looks just like a leaf.
Yeah. Yeah, some of them have just an amazing coloration on the wings. They can blend in very well, and some of that may be for defensive purposes.
Let's go to Jim in Wausau next. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for the opportunity. This is about a month ago. As I was harvesting fall raspberries, I would frequently come across a ladybug on the fruit. I think it was the Asian kind. It seemed lighter colored than our normal. And it didn't seem to be eating the fruit, but perhaps psychologically it didn't seem to taste as good as the other raspberries. I was just wondering what they were doing on the fruit if they weren't eating it.
Sure. So the Asian lady beetles will nibble on fruits on occasion. Now, when I see them on fruits, I really think of them as being a secondary pest. So typically, they're not going to go up and just start feeding on sound, intact fruit. But if you have fruit that has been damaged for whatever reason, storm damage, another insect had damaged them a bit, they've just been bumped around and bruised, and you get some sugars and liquid oozing out that starts to ferment, you can get all kinds of other insects in there. The lady beetles, you can get yellow jackets and ants and things like that. So it's actually fairly common to see those lady beetles hanging out in orchard or fruit production situations.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Back to Facebook for a minute because we've got another cool photo here from Michael. He says, super scary wasp, I should say. Saw three of them in the backyard.
Sure. So this is a wasp from the family Ichneumonidae. And I can't quite see it well enough in the picture to tell the genus. I suspect it may be one of the giant ichneumon wasps from the genus Megarissa, and we've got 3-4 species in the state. Now, the thing to note about this one is off the back end of the body, there is this long filament, which looks like it's about 3, 4, 5 inches long. So it looks intimidating in appearance. It looks like that thing could chase you down and sting you right through your arm. But that's actually not a stinger. That is a specialized drilling device, and I can tell that this one is a female because she has that. She will take her drilling device, her ovipositor, and drill into soft, rotting wood. So typically you'd find these if you have a tree stump or a rotting tree nearby. She drills into the wood, lays an egg, and her egg hatches and parasitizes other insects living in the wood. So really cool insects, neat life cycles, harmless to people, but I think they're rather pretty-looking insects.
Yeah, they are. Boy, as you're listening today, and if you're on our Facebook page, I would recommend you go to the Facebook page and take a look at some of these insects because they really are very cool. Jim and Eau Claire up next. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry. I got a question. I just discovered something about stinging insects, and it's the red velvet ant, and I Googled it, and it says it's somewhere in Wisconsin, and they call it the cow killer ant because the sting is so painful, I guess. Is it here, and where? If it is here, where is it?
Yes, so velvet ants are here, and it turns out there are many, many species in the state alone. And even though they look like ants, they basically look like large fuzzy ants, they are actually a type of wingless wasp. Now, to find these, you really won't bump into them unless you're in a part of the state with sandy soil. These things are strongly associated with sandy soil. That's what they need for their nesting and to go through their life cycle. So a lot of folks just don't bump into them. Now, they do get their nickname of the cow killer because they do have a rather potent sting. And so if you hop onto YouTube, there's all kinds of videos of people finding out firsthand that you don't want to get stung by these particular little creatures. But they are definitely around. There's a number of species. Actually, our curator here at UW-Madison, the Wisconsin Insect Research Collection, Craig Brabant, he had studied these things for years. And so he has studied velvet ants from around the world and is kind of our local expert on the topic.
Yeah, very interesting. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate the call. Back to Facebook for a second because Melissa sent us a photo of a she said, about a month ago, I saw this guy in my car outside the grocery store in Madison. That's another cool-looking insect there. And it looks black or dark brown with pretty large.
Yeah, so this comes from a family we call the leaf-footed bugs. And if you are checking out the Facebook pictures, to tie in with that name, if you look at the hind legs, they are very widened and dilated, and they're very thin, so it looks kind of like a leaf in appearance. This particular species we call the western conifer seed bug. And they can be very common in the state. They feed on the seed cones of trees such as pines and spruce and fir and things like that. They don't seem to cause a whole lot of damage to the trees. But in the fall, just like the Asian lady beetles and box elder bugs, these things like to sneak indoors to find a sheltered spot. And so it's not uncommon to see these things on the side of stores and homes and other buildings, sheds and things
like
that.
And how long do they, how long are they?
They are about, I'd say, 3/4 inch long, maybe an inch long. So they're decent-sized insects.
PJ Leash, our guest today, the guy who manages the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects with PJ Leash today from the UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Eleanor in Dodgeville has something for us. Let's go to her. Hi, Eleanor. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm responding to the caller with the flea problem.
Yeah.
I have a solution that worked for us. Years ago, we had the problem, and we had a shag carpet in the living room at that time. So the vacuum didn't do everything. So what we did was we took a low dish or pan and put warm water in it and then a squirt of Dawn soap. And then you take a desk lamp and you shine it on the water and it keeps a warm place and the fleas come toward it, jump in the water and die.
Huh.
I
have not.
Works.
I never heard of that. Well, thanks for calling, Eleanor. And is there should be some science behind that in a way.
Yeah, I've heard of folks using these methods for fleas. In some cases, it can be used for detection if you think you might have fleas, but you just haven't seen them yet. And we know that fleas do respond to things such as warm, so it makes sense. To entirely trap the fleas out, I think you'd have to probably be pretty vigilant with a technique like that. But I would say there is probably some truth behind it. That
yeah.
With that heat, it could draw them in, and it will cause them to jump in, and they may drown in that soapy water.
So you combine that with maybe, you know, some vacuuming, regular vacuuming?
Yeah.
Maybe between the two?
Right. Yeah. The thing with fleas is you really can't pick one approach. You have to do a lot of different things, and just be very thorough is probably the best message overall.
Yeah. Thanks, Eleanor. Appreciate the call. Yeah, appreciate it. Let's go to Dee in Madison next. Hi, Dee. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I have a couple bugs that are so odd, I can't find them anywhere. I was cleaning out a piece of chocolate that had fallen down, and the bugs were coming out of the chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, huh?
One of them was maybe the size of a grain of rice, and it had a brown body, and it was kind of flat, I would say. Maybe like two segments, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And when I crushed it, it just crumbled to dust.
Okay.
And then the other one was smaller. It was the tiniest thing, and it when I crushed it, it smelled like a mothball. And I had, in order to see it, I had to look at it with, like, a really high-powered magnifying glass. Okay. And it had wings, like real shiny wings.
Okay.
And it was kind of an ant-like body, but the bottom part was kind of pointy like a wasp.
Okay. Well, for the first creature, the little kind of reddish-brown creature, probably one of our stored product beetles. And there are a number of beetles that will get into food items in the pantry. They can go after things like pasta and rice and things like that. But they go after other plant-based foods as well, so sometimes bulk spices and tea. Some I have seen in chocolate, such as the sawtooth grain beetle. Every once in a while we'll get a case where they had moved into chocolate, and we'll feed on that. In terms of dealing with them, you basically have to find infested food sources and get rid of them, clean them up or throw them out. Or if they were in something like pet treats, you throw it in the freezer for a couple of days to kill them off. But generally, it's just a matter of cleaning them up.
Okay.
Now, the second creature has me stumped based on the description in terms of smelling, you know, a little bit like mothballs, like naphthalene.
Yeah.
If you ever see something like that again and can snap a picture or collect one and get it into me, then I'll be able to get a much better idea of what it might be. But until I can see a picture, that one's got me scratching my head a bit.
Yeah, and it's for how small it is, the smell is so intense. It's like the tiniest little, and the only reason I smelled it is because I was looking, trying to look at it.
Sure.
But it was just the strongest smell. And then it's so tiny, I don't know how I would ever...
Sure.
Be able to take a picture of it.
Well, for small things like that, sometimes it is tricky to get a picture. And so if there's ever something really small, like ants, for example, I typically ask folks to send in some physical specimens to look at under the microscope. Now, when it comes to the smell, we know there's an awful lot of insects that produce chemical defenses so that something else won't eat them. They just taste bad. There are certain ants that can smell like citronella. Some smell like rotten coconut. There are some of our true bugs that have scent glands and can have very strong odors associated with them. So there's a lot of different possibilities. But if you ever see them again, get some specimens to me, and I'll certainly take a peek for you under the microscope.
Okay, that would be cool. And then there was one last one. It was a tiny, really long, like a million legs red insect that I found curled up in like a damp cloth.
Sure.
And I don't know if it was just like the beginning stages of a, like a centipede or something, but I mean, it was really, really, really skinny.
Okay. Well, we do have some unusual types of centipedes out there, like our stone, and we've got soil centipedes, and there's a lot of different types of centipedes. Some of them are extremely skinny, and they've got these short little legs that stick out to the side, and they tend to be a bright red color. So sounds like you probably ran into one of these more unusual centipedes. Typically, I would find them outdoors under rocks or beneath the bark of a rotting log, but occasionally they will sneak into people's homes in the basement or elsewhere through a patio door or something like that.
Yep, it was the basement.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Dee.
Okay. Thank you.
You can join in, too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. 1-800-642-1234. We've got some great photos up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. If you've got one you want to share with us, we'd love to have that as well. And, of course, you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I mentioned in the beginning we might talk about bed bugs. They like to travel around a little bit, and there seems to be more instances of infestations lately.
Yeah, so bed bugs really have an interesting story. If we went back in the history books a couple hundred years ago, bed bugs were fairly common. People just had to deal with them on a regular basis. Once we got to World War II, right around that time in the mid-1940s, we had the invention of synthetic insecticides that basically nearly wiped out bed bugs globally. And so for several decades, people just didn't see them. I mean, they were rare. Entomologists would get excited to find one. In the last 20 years or so, there has been this reemergence of bed bugs, and they have shown up a couple decades ago in the U.S. in larger cities where we had a lot of international travelers and trade and airports and big hotels and things like that. But over time, they have spread across the U.S. You can find them in small town hotels in some cases, and it really is a matter of where they have been brought by people. Bed bugs are really good hitchhikers, and so it's just something to be aware of with the upcoming holiday travel season, that if you're staying in hotels or renting an Airbnb and things like that, it can be worth the time and effort to check for bed bugs. So looking around the mattress and box spring and bed frames for any signs of bed bugs. And if you've never seen a bed bug, a lot of folks think they are too small to see with the naked eye, but that's not true. The adult bed bugs, about the same size, color, and shape as apple seeds. Okay. So you can spot those. You can look for their droppings, the digested blood. The best analogy I can make, if you can imagine having a black ballpoint pen that is maybe a little bit leaky, if you touch that to paper and you get these black ink splotches, that's what their droppings look like. So if you see something like that on the mattress or box springs, that would be a clue that you could be having some bed bugs at that location. So bed bugs are definitely something folks need to be aware of. You really don't want to bring them home because they are frustrating to try and get rid of on your own. You really need to hire a pest control company to do so.
You know, when I travel, I usually work, my clothes are in the suitcase and they just stay I usually don't even hang them up. I kind of live out of the suitcase that way, and I don't know if that helps, but...
Well, that would help to a certain extent. Probably the worst thing you could do is get into your hotel room, throw your suitcase on the bed, and then wander out to have dinner and come back you know, in the wee hours of the night after having some beers and forget about bed bugs. Bed bugs, they will come out at night, feed, and then they wander around. They spend most of their time hiding. They might only feed once a week or so. And so they will look for any nooks and crannies. If you think of luggage with all the zippers and things like that, there's a lot of little places they could potentially hide. So it's also worth it, after you've been doing some traveling, to inspect suitcases as well, just to make sure there weren't any hitchhikers. But if you have things in your suitcase, and if you're maybe leery of bed bugs, if you leave your suitcase in a place where bed bugs aren't likely to be, such as the bathroom tub or the bathroom counter, it's smooth, bright surfaces, bed bugs aren't as likely going to be in those locations compared to around the bed.
Sue in Appleton has a question for us. Hi, Sue.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My call was actually about bed bugs, and I had turned you off so I didn't get the feedback, so I missed part of your conversation. But to my horror, we had bed bugs this year, and we called the pest control company. They came in, they sprayed, they did everything, and the gentleman reassured me that it's not because I was an unclean person or an unclean house or any of that, that probably we had done some traveling, and because bed bugs are hitchhikers, that's where they came from. But this was in my second home, and I'm really worried about, like, am I going to be transferring them to my primary home? And now I have a really hard time sleeping in my second home because I'm always worried about these bugs munching on me in the middle of the night. And we did put our mattresses and everything in the bags, So I guess any recommendations you have for me to make sure these things never come back again would, and that I can sleep again in my own bed, would be great.
Sure. Yeah. Well, when it comes to bed bugs in general, if anyone gets them in their home, my first recommendation is get in touch with a pest control company. Technically, if you know exactly what you're doing, you know what products to get, how to use them, where to use them, you can get rid of bed bugs by yourself. But in most cases, when the public tries to do that on their own, they're not thorough enough or they miss things. And in some cases, some of the things you can do can actually make the bed bug situation worse. For example, the typical bug bombs you can get at the hardware store. In theory, if you put bed bugs in a plastic sealed box with a bug bomb, you're probably going to kill them. In the real world, if you let off a bug bomb in your house, the bed bugs are hiding in wall voids and places like that. They don't get exposed, and it can actually irritate them and force them to flee and basically scatter. So it can make the problem much worse. So contacting a pest control company. Pest control companies have really had to pick up all the techniques and equipment over the last couple years because it's become a pretty big business for them. But they know how to get rid of these things appropriately. In most cases, a single treatment can do a very good job of eliminating them. Every once in a while, you may need some follow-up treatment. So at this point, my general advice would be just keep a general eye out for anything suspicious. You can still do an inspection of mattress and box springs, see if you noticed anything or if you noticed any bites or skin irritation. You could always call the pest control company back. But in most cases, you get the pest control company, they come in and they treat, and that should take care of things fairly quickly.
Yep, and that's what we did. They came back actually twice, and it's been several months with no issues. So
sure.
Hopefully they're long gone, but it's still, once you have them, oh my gosh, you worry about, you don't ever want those things coming back. And you
sure.
check every mattress you sleep on, and
Yeah, so along those lines, there's a good book by Brooke Burrell that came out that talks about bed bugs and the psychology of it. Worth checking out.
All right, there we go. We will take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, then we'll be right back. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, P.J. Leash, who directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison, and, of course, talking the world of insects with him. Questions for him? Call at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post a photo and or question on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And speaking of that, earlier we were talking about weird, strange insects that we've discovered here in Wisconsin that you've observed. And Rick sent us a photo of a rusty patched bumblebee, and that's one of the other insects that kind of strange that you've found this year.
Yeah, so this is a native species to our area. So it's not necessarily anything that moved in, but it's just very rare and uncommon. Although at one point they used to be much more abundant. So the rusty patch bumblebee is a species of bumblebee that many folks might have heard about in the news recently because there's some talk about putting it on the federal endangered species list because it has faced such stark declines in recent history. But Rick, who is a regular listener to the show, had sent me some pictures, and sure enough, I could identify it based on the reddish patch on the abdomen. And so it is this very rare bumblebee that was spotted in Pheasant Branch Conservancy in Middleton, Wisconsin. So people can make these discoveries even in their own backyard of these really cool and uncommon and rare insects.
You had a couple of other insects that were a little different this year, botflies for one.
Yeah, so botflies are just bizarre creatures. And in a given year, I might get one report or one case of botfly in an entire calendar year. Well, in the months of July and August, I was probably getting two or more reports of botflies a week. And if you're not familiar with a botfly, this is a type of fly where the larvae or maggots actually infest the flesh of other animals. So we've got species that live beneath the skin of rabbits and rodents like mice and chipmunks and things like that. And it was just unusual that I was getting the volume of reports that I was. So for whatever reason this year, the botflies just had a heck of a year out there in Wisconsin.
And praying mantis as well.
Yeah, so I did notice a distinct uptick in reports of praying mantids this year. Now, mantids aren't native to Wisconsin. Every once in a while, we get reports. These insects do much better in warmer southern climates. And if you think of the weather history the last few years, that brutal winter basically knocked the praying mantids out of the state. We didn't have many sightings for the last couple of years. But we just came through a very mild winter, so any egg cases that were present would have had a better chance of surviving. So I had just a whole bunch of reports and sightings of praying mantids, some even here on the UW-Madison campus this summer and fall.
Very cool. Jackie in Milwaukee has a question for us. Jackie, hello.
You can put this up as number one queer question. I've got a dog I let in and out into a fence yard through an open door, and I, as a result, I get a lot of flies. Years ago on this program, I'm quite sure I heard that when flies take off, they fly backwards. And I wonder if I have my memory correct, because when I go to hit them, it seems as if I don't hit them so that they're going to be flying backwards, I may miss them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any truth?
Well, when you look at flies and how they can produce flight, they are really great acrobats. I mean, they can do some very complex maneuvers. We have some such as hover flies that can hover perfectly in space just like a hummingbird. And so there is truth to that, that there are cases where flies can basically move backwards. So they do definitely have those flight capabilities.
Hooray!
There you go, Jackie. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Jason in Janesville. Your turn. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call. It's funny you're just talking about praying mantis. I've never seen one here in Wisconsin, and I just saw one a couple of days ago out in the parking lot crawling up a wall. So that was kind of interesting. However, that's not the reason for my call. This goes back quite a few years now, and it was just getting to be evening, and it was just me and a few buddies standing out in the driveway. And one of my friends just started going crazy, looking at in my other friend's direction. And well, he turned around, and there's this bug on its back. It must have been 4 to 5 inches long, narrow. It was very colorful. The more prominent colors were like a shiny blue, kind of mixed with like a green, and it was like a shell type back. And we couldn't get it off. You know, we're waving at it. And when it finally did decide to release from them, it had a wingspan like I had never seen. And I thought, you know, my original thought was maybe it was somebody's pet that, you know, somebody that collected insects or something that had gotten out, because I have never since then seen anything like it.
Hmm. Sure. Any ideas on that one, PJ?
A couple thoughts. I mean, when it comes to really big insects, there's not a particularly long list in the Midwest. Praying mantids and walking sticks would be in this group. The thing I'm wondering about, we have a creature called a giant water bug. And some of the species can easily be several inches long, so they're getting close to that length that we're talking about. Typically, they aren't particularly brightly colored, though. They tend to have a lot of greens and browns on their body. But they do fly and leave from bodies of water, and they're attracted to light. So if they had just been in an aquatic area, they could have had a sheen due to bits of water on the body. And so that's what I would wonder. Maybe if you did a Google search for giant water bug, see if that rings a bell.
Are they typically roundish, the water bug?
No, they kind of have an oblong body to them.
Okay, yeah, it was similar to that.
Okay, yeah, I would really wonder then if that's what you might have bumped into.
It just, when it took off, that wingspan, oh my goodness. It was amazing to see.
Sure.
Terrifying, too. Terrifying. Okay, well, thanks for taking my call.
Oh, yeah, thanks, Jason. Appreciate the call. Look that up on your computer and take a look and see if PJ wasn't right. Fred in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Fred.
Hi. I'm actually calling about the property on the shore of Lake Superior. We have had an infestation of, evidently it's called spruce budworm.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about controlling that. And then a secondary question is, often along the shore of Lake Superior,
Superior, we have infestation of the locals call them fish flies. And if you could talk a little bit about those.
Okay.
Sure.
So spruce budworm is a type of caterpillar that can cause very extensive damage to conifers in the North Woods. And down here in Madison area, we just don't see them. You got to go up around Lake Superior area. And so they have much bigger problems with this insect up in places like Canada where there's boreal forest and more of the coniferous trees. But they definitely can cause lots of damage. They tend to go through these long-term population cycles where you can get square miles deforested, and then things may quiet down for some time. And so I have colleagues at the DNR that keep an eye on what the spruce budworm is doing in the northern part of the state.
There's not much the homeowner can do?
Not a whole lot, just because if you think of the sheer numbers of these insects on a landscape scale, it's kind of mind-boggling. And for the sheer amount of damage that they can do, there's not a whole lot of things that are out there. If you had small trees, potentially, there could be some sprays that could be used at the right time to deal with them. But for large trees, we don't really have any good options.
Thank you.
What about these fish flies?
Yes, so the fish flies, we have these insects called fish flies, and they can have a big wingspan. We're talking 3-4 inches. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of different species out there. These are aquatic insects. And so the larvae live in aquatic areas. In a lot of cases, it may be in either lakes or streams or rivers. If anyone is into fishing, a certain type of fishing bait called a helgramite is actually the larva of one of these related creatures from the family of fish flies. So they can be very large insects, going to be harmless to people, but if you're in the right spot at the right time of the year and there's an emergence of them, you can find an awful lot of them.
Yeah. You definitely can. I've been in situations going across near Portage, I believe, where there were millions of them on a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks, Fred. Appreciate the call.
Very much. Appreciate it.
Pat in Land O'Lakes, it's your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. See, we had something about 2 weeks ago up here, and it was during the daytime. It looked like a hatch of baby mosquitoes almost. They were all over. And they'd come in the house. You'd bring them in the house, and I got them really bad in the camper because I was cleaning it out, and every time I opened the door, they were in there, and then I thought I had the camper totally clean, and I went in there a couple days later, and these things are just thick on all my windows in there, and they're hard to kill, and they're just all over the place, and they look like baby mosquitoes. And I was just wondering what the heck they were. We've never had them before.
Hmm. Sure. So my suspicion is that they may be something along the lines of a midge. And there's lots of different species of midges out there. Sometimes people call midges lake flies because they can emerge from lakes and other bodies of water in very, very large numbers. They're somewhat related to mosquitoes, so they do have a similar appearance, except midges can't bite. And there's a lot of different species of midges, so some can be noticeably bigger than mosquitoes. Other ones can be teeny tiny. Some are small enough they can fit through the screens that cover your windows at night, and so they can be attracted to lights and come into buildings. Now, the thing is, they don't live terribly long. So I wouldn't worry about them too much. Even if they get into a camper, I would maybe just check back in a week or two, because any of them that were around should die in that time, and then just vacuum them up at that point.
Okay, because that's what they were. They were teeny tiny, and some of them I swore were coming through the screens, and they were attracted to light. That I will say, because I had everything pretty dark in there because it was closed up already, but they were like hanging on the windows underneath the blinds.
Yeah, there you go. That's what they were. I would almost bet on it. Thanks, Pat. Thanks for calling. Jane in Appleton, you are next. Hi, Jane.
Hi there. I would like to know if there is any kind of a spider. Once or twice a year, I will get bitten by what I'm sure is a spider. But it leaves two, if you want to say fangs, you know, two spots always about a quarter of an inch apart, and it's usually around the ankles, and I don't see them. I don't see anything around me. I may have socks and pants and jeans on or something, and they still get me on more or less the ankle part. And those two marks don't go away for well over a year.
Boy.
Well, so this doesn't sound like spiders to me.
No.
In theory, if a spider did bite, you would most likely notice two puncture marks fairly close together. And the smaller the spider, the closer the puncture marks. But arachnologists have looked at spider behavior, and it turns out spiders very rarely bite people. They just don't have a reason to. They are predators of tiny insects and things like that. And so spiders just don't walk up to people and bite them on the ankles and things like that. And especially with marks being around for long periods of time, I'm not entirely sure what would cause those marks, but I suspect it's something other than a spider.
Could be.
I don't know what it would be.
Yeah, there are things, there are little bugs that sort of congregate around, your waist, your belt area, or your sock area.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of things you could bump into outdoors, chiggers and things like that, although I wouldn't expect just two.
Right.
I think you'd get lots and lots of bites. We do also have to keep in mind that there are lots of things that can cause skin irritation that looks just like an insect or a potential spider bite. And we also have to keep in mind that in some cases, people don't react right away to something when it occurs. Some folks with mosquitoes, you welt up right away. In other cases, you notice a welt the next day. So everyone reacts differently. And so it can make it very challenging to figure out what caused the skin irritation. There's a possibility it could have been something that occurred 2, 3, 4 days or longer even before that.
Oh, interesting. Thanks, Jane. Appreciate the call. And Kim in Burlington has something for us. Hi, Kim.
Hello?
Hi. What's on your mind today?
Yeah. You were talking about brown recluses earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. A couple of years back, we had a farm that was out in Burlington, out in the country. Not that far from the train tracks, though. Probably about a mile or so. And I had some flip-flops on. I was out in front of my wooden barn, and I got bit. Thought it was a fire ant. You know, got stuck in between my flip-flop and my foot. So it swelled up, and the next day it got bigger, and then it got bigger, and then I could see the two little white marks, the fang marks. And eventually then it just got so large, it turned like purple-gray. All my skin lifted up. It killed all my skin. The whole top of my foot just, like, you know, peeled off. And then I didn't go to the doctor, nothing, because everybody kept telling me it was a brown recluse and they would have to, you know, do something like surgery on my foot. It scared me. My son's goat got bit twice. Same thing.
Hmm.
You know, just fell off. You were saying that brown recluses are only in the Appleton area?
Well, so overall, brown recluse spiders have only been found in the state a few times. And in those cases, they are restricted to, you know, a single home or a single building. Other than that, we just don't bump into them. They're not the type of spider you'd bump into outdoors wandering around. And overall, if you look into the biology of these spiders, they just very, very rarely bite people. So it wouldn't make sense that people would be getting multiple bites of these spiders when, for the most part, they really don't occur in the state. And a very well-known arachnologist, Rick Vetter, had written a book about that very topic, because even by the medical community, there are a lot of these essentially false reports where folks would diagnose it as brown recluse spider bite, and yet really the cause was some other underlying medical condition, a bacterial infection or something else going on that will cause an unusual lesion or some other severe reaction. But given the description you just provided, I would almost be certain that it wasn't brown recluse spiders. It just doesn't sound like the type of behavior or the type of reactions that they would cause. And in most cases, 90%+ of verified brown recluse bite cases, you get a little bit of localized redness, and that's about it. So it's really rare circumstances that someone actually gets bitten, and even rarer case that someone gets a very severe lesion on their body from a brown recluse bite.
What could cause that kind of a lesion?
Well, so the same arachnologist that started debunking all these myths about brown recluse spiders, he started looking at potential causes for other things. I mean, there's a very long list of potential medical conditions. In a lot of cases, they were finding these lesions when they got reported to hospitals were things like MRSA, where you get this bacterial infection that just kind of sits there and smolders and can cause some major skin problems. So a lot of cases, it was probably some type of bacterial infection that was leading to those ulcers.
And then as it swelled up, it was like the second day you could actually see the tooth bite mark, the tooth fang.
Well, so still that doesn't quite fit the profile of spider bites. Even when we have documented brown recluse bites, they don't swell up overnight and start oozing and things like that. Actually, the venom from that spider cuts off blood supply to the wound, and so you basically get a very dry spot where that spider would have bitten if there is a severe reaction. But as I said, in most cases, there's very little, and it's just a localized reaction.
I think he wrote in his book, if I remember, there he cited a family that had a bunch of brown recluse spiders in their home, and they never got bit.
Right, yeah. So here's the thing you have to put in perspective. You think of places like Oklahoma and Arkansas and some of the south central states. People have thousands of brown recluse spiders in their home and never be bitten. And so it just is not a creature that goes out of its way to bite. If you, in theory, you know, had one smushed against an article of clothing, it may bite defensively. But overall, they just don't seem to bite, and they just don't seem to cause the severe reactions that really gets hyped up online.
So if that one happens again, Kim, you probably should go in and...
Yeah.
And have somebody look, as if it could be a bacterial infection, you're saying.
Yeah, potentially. And in a lot of cases, they were finding that with those ulcerating wounds that were blamed on spider bites, there was something other underlying condition that was the actual cause.
Yeah, very interesting. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to jump back to our Facebook page because we got a couple of more cool pictures. Janine sent us one of a kind of a long tan, almost fawn color.
Yeah, so from what I can see, this looks like it's from the grasshopper and katydid group, the order Orthoptera. I suspect this is probably one of our cone-headed katydids, because if you look at the cone, it's slanted forward, look at the head, it's slanted forward with a very cone-like appearance.
Mm. And here's one from Nathan. He says, check out this monster. I found it in Cherokee Marsh in the Madison area, of course.
Yeah. This is an impressive spider. Based on the general appearance, I suspect this is probably one of our wolf spiders, and they can be very common in many places in the state. Whenever you bump into very large spiders, it tends to be one of our wolf spiders or one of our fishing spiders that can also be common near bodies of water.
And they're not likely to be biting you.
No. In general, spiders are pretty unlikely to bite people.
I want to go back to bed bugs for just a minute because at our news break you mentioned a book, and I didn't get the title and author of that book, and people may be interested in that.
Sure. So a relatively recent book by Brooke Borrell, and the title of the book is Infested, and it's a pretty short read, probably 250 pages. Does a good job of summarizing what has happened to bed bugs over the last several hundred years, and in certainly more recent times, talks about the spread of them into the U.S. in the last decade or two. And it really goes into some interesting aspects about the psychological effects that bed bugs can have in terms of sleepless nights and loss of work and things like that. And the author had experienced bed bugs herself, so she is writing from the viewpoint of a person that has dealt with those things firsthand. So really a good book to check out.
So Brooke Borrell, B-U-R-R-E-L?
I believe it's B-O-R-E-L.
Oh, B-O-R-E-L, and the title of the book is Infested.
Infested, yeah.
And it sounded like our caller was going through some of the things you just described.
Yeah.
It could be a pretty miserable experience.
Yeah, I've never experienced bed bugs myself.
I hope you don't want to.
But they certainly can take a toll because they can be frustrating. They really cause some significant skin irritation for some people. So just not a fun insect to have to deal with.
BJ, always a pleasure. You're back on January 18th, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so.
Thank you so much. BJ Leish, who directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, he'll be back January 18th. Tomorrow at this time, Chef Terry Milligan is back with us to talk about creating great holiday food. So I hope you will join us for that. In the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.